Well, good morning, and welcome to the Manhattan Institute's second policy briefing in the lead-up to New York City's mayoral race. We're honored to have two men in the room who just might be mayor, Republican candidates Joe Loda and George McDonald. Thank you both for coming and showing a direct interest in what we're doing, and also the staffs from the campaigns of Adolfo Carrion and John Katsimatidis, and I'm not sure if there's anyone else, any other campaigns represented. But that was the intent of this project. And of course, the Republican Party Chairman, Ed Cox, thank you as well for being here. So my name is Mike Allegretti. I run the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. And this year, we have taken a special interest in the New York City mayoral race. That's why you're all here. And there's general concern that this race presents unique challenges. There's apprehension about what comes after 20 years of Rudy Giuliani and Mike Bloomberg's leadership, admittedly different styles, but on a similar track. What will happen in the areas of public safety, fiscal policy, and education specifically? Recognizing what's been at stake, what is at stake, the Manhattan Institute and our quarterly magazine, City Journal, have decided to weigh into this process and try to help direct the debate in a more constructive way. We've done this with a three-pronged approach. First, we commissioned a study with Zogby Analytics. This was a 1,000-plus person survey, so a very robust poll looking at the moods and the policy views of New Yorkers. We'll talk about that in a moment. On May 13th, Larry Mohn went on New York One's Inside City Hall, releasing the results of this poll, and you've seen it talked about throughout the last month, and more than that even, in the press and other venues. Second, about 2 weeks ago, I think, Brian, we released the special issue of City Journal, so five issues in 1 year. That's a hefty lift. It's entitled After Bloomberg, An Agenda for New York. You have a copy. It's self-explanatory. If the next mayor reads this magazine, we shouldn't have any problems, provided they act on it. So you guys, you're on the right step here, so thank you. And you've heard a report in New York Post and other places. And finally, we're hosting these briefings. So before I turn the mic over to my colleague, Brian Anderson, who's going to introduce our panel and moderate our discussion on fiscal policy, today's topic, I want to tell you a bit about the poll. And for those of you who came to our first briefing, I'll try to pepper in some new statistics. We start with the bad news. New York is in a precarious fiscal situation. I don't see any looks of surprise on any of your faces. Fewer than half of New Yorkers think that the city is headed in the right direction. An alarming 57% of those aged 18 to 49 would consider leaving this city. And 70% think that the city is simply too expensive to live in, and they're contemplating, therefore, going somewhere. Now, thanks to rising spending, especially as a result of exploding public sector personnel costs, the city faces a budget scenario that will make it difficult for the next mayor to maintain basic services, let alone start to spend money on those things that voters say they might want or that campaigns often say they need to spend money on. So that is the next mayor's dilemma. Secondly, New Yorkers have noticed the impact of this higher spending on the services that they're getting. And you see surveys, the results here, 8% saying the MTA is excellent, 40% saying it's good. There's a direct correlation, what we call crowd out, on public sector labor costs taking away money for other things such as transportation, parks, libraries, cops, fire, et cetera. Now, despite these subpar services, New Yorkers do want, and we see this as bad news, they do want to keep pumping money into a few things. Specifically, they say social services and education. It's unclear to us if they know exactly what the right amount is, how much we're already spending on these things, what they really think a social service is. But it's important to note that when you throw that out, they say, no, we should put more into social services and education. 50% say more money should go into subsidized housing. And this is the big one here. New Yorkers are willing to spend more on public education. We spend $19,000 per pupil here. That's almost double the national average of about $10,300. So now for the good news. New Yorkers are ready for the next mayor to rein in escalating costs. Social services and education aside, they're saying we don't want to spend more on certain things. For example, while 62% of them say, yeah, we should have more public transit, we should expand the system. 59 say they're not going to pay more taxes for it. So we see that as a promising step. Second, New Yorkers are beginning to recognize that not everyone in this city is pulling his or her weight fairly. And there's one stat, and I'm sure our panelists will speak about it. 60% of those polled said that city employees should contribute to their own health insurance on the same basis as private sector workers. Take that in for a moment. That's across all subgroups, ages, Republicans, Democrats, union, non-union households, public-private workers. It's exciting. So finally, New York City clearly supports a series of bold public safety and education reforms. That's the third piece of good news. We're not going to go into those today. You have a copy of the poll, I believe, at your place setting. But education will be the subject of our third policy briefing on July 9th, and our prior one was focused on public safety. But for those of you who care about those issues, there's a lot of good stuff there. School choice, proactive policing, more evaluation for teachers, those marks are in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So with that in mind, I turn the mic over to my colleague Brian Anderson and our esteemed panel. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Michael. A big theme of the issue, as Michael mentioned, is New York's economy. It's seemingly done pretty well during the Bloomberg era, at least parts of it have. Real earnings in Manhattan rose 18% between 1998 and 2010, for example. But the healthy appearance isn't the whole story, as our panelists today, all of whom wrote important essays in the special issue, will make clear. New York faces very real fiscal, tax, regulatory, and infrastructure challenges to its continued prosperity. So let me briefly introduce our distinguished panelists who will discuss each of these challenges. The panelists will speak for 5 minutes each, then I'll ask them a few questions, following which the panel will receive questions from the audience. In asking questions, please keep them very brief, with each person asking just one question and no long-winded statements attached, please. And I think we have a mic, so wait for the mic during the question period. The panelists. Nicole Gelinas is a City Journal contributing editor. She's the Searle Freedom Trust Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of the 2009 book, After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. She writes regularly on economics, municipal and corporate finance, and business issues, and her columns appear in the New York Post regularly, the Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, many other publications. She's a chartered financial analyst and a member of the New York Society of Securities Analysts. Ed Glaser is a professor of economics at Harvard University, as well as a City Journal contributing editor and a Manhattan Institute senior fellow. He's published widely on issues involving cities and economic growth, and he's the author of the 2011 bestseller, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Steve Malanga is the senior editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a columnist for Real Clear Markets. He's the author most recently of the 2010 book, Shakedown, The Continuing Conspiracy Against the American Taxpayer. Prior to joining City Journal, Steve was the executive editor of Crain's New York Business, and he's been cited as one of Governor Chris Christie's intellectual influences. E.J. McMahon is a Manhattan Institute's senior fellow for tax and budgetary studies, and a senior fellow at the Albany-based Empire Center for New York State Policy. His recent work has included studies focusing on New York's public pension and retiree health care costs, the out-migration of New York residents to other states, and proposals for restructuring New York's deficit-ridden state budget. And he writes regularly for the New York Post, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. EJ played the lead role in formulating Governor Pataki's personal income tax cut back in 1995. So with that, we'll start with Ed Glaser. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, and I'm really delighted to be here. There once was a city that was the wonder of the world. It was built on a great waterway. It was created by entrepreneurs who changed the world and even gave their name to an era. Its workers helped win a world war, and in 1950 it was probably the most productive place on the planet. Now, the past 60 years have not been as kind to this city, and it is currently in bankruptcy. Many things went wrong in Detroit. It misinvested in education. It underinvested in safety. But perhaps most difficult, most problematically, its world, its ecosystem of small, nimble entrepreneurs was replaced by a stultifying oligopoly of small, of large companies, which dominated itself. If you go back to the 1950s, when the economist Ben Chinnitz was trying to understand why New York City remained so resilient even then, he compared it with Pittsburgh. Chinnitz pointed out that New York had an industrial history that was incredibly friendly towards entrepreneurship. Our great industrial cluster, garment manufacturing, and let's not forget, garment manufacturing in the 1950s was the largest industrial cluster in the United States, much bigger than automobile production in Detroit. But that industry was one in which anyone with a good idea and a couple of sewing machines could get started, and it was a mother of entrepreneurship. By contrast, General Motors, U.S. Steel, these trained company men, not entrepreneurs. And while these were great, you know, great things to have, great companies to have in the short run, they were not dynamic. They did not help things change. And when things went wrong for these industries, those company men couldn't figure out a new future. Now, I think about Detroit, and I think about New York. We also have a golden, magical industry that is the wonder of the world that prints money. 40% of the payroll in the island of Manhattan is in one narrow cluster of finance and insurance. It also is dominated by very big firms at this point in time. Three other relatively narrow industrial clusters make up another 30% of the payroll on the island of Manhattan. I fear that the city that once was marked by nimble entrepreneurs is a city that is increasingly becoming marked by large-scale financial service companies, which are great to have. New York is blessed to have these companies. But they are not a recipe for long-run reinvention of the city, because there needs to be constant churning of a city. Right? Because New York will never win if the objective is just to have low costs. It needs to have constant innovation, constant coming up with new companies and with new ideas. Across the country, those metropolitan areas and those counties that had on average the smallest average firm sizes, the fifth, grew three times faster between 1977 and 2009 than those counties that had the largest firm sizes. Small firms and entrepreneurship are really critical for urban success. Now, what does this actually mean for New York? What actually can we do to encourage entrepreneurship, to make this city less hostile to new businesses? And let's not forget that one of the findings of that Zogby poll was that 67% of respondents considered the current environment for the growth and development of small business in New York poor or fair, right? A 2013 survey performed by Thumbtack.com and the Kauffman Foundation gave New York a grade of D for the ease of starting a new business. This is not a place in which it is easy to get started doing something new, and that's something to be worried about. These are not entrepreneurs on the edge of things, because those entrepreneurs end up being Henry Ford, right? They end up being the people who actually make a city change, make a city better. Now, when I think about the mayoral election, one of the things that worries me, and this came through very much in the poll results mentioned earlier, is that far too many New Yorkers don't understand the nature of cities in the modern world. We are not guaranteed success in this city. Detroit was not guaranteed success, even though it certainly looked as if it had it, right? One of the things I think that is somewhat healthier about Boston's mayoral election than New York's right now is Boston knows it's a cold city on the edge of the country and can't solve all of its problems by just spending more on it, right? More New York voters need to know that as well. Now, I think there are really three things that possibly that should be done, right? One of which is focusing on the tax burden. There are two elements to this. One element involves making sure at least the costs of government don't go up. I am always skeptical of mayoral candidates or gubernatorial candidates who promise massive reductions in the cost of government. I would love to see it, but it's always promised out of waste, fraud, and abuse, and I have yet to actually see any of that realized. But if anyone can do that, that's great. But at least some sense that we should be limiting the growth of government is important. The other element in terms of the cost, the tax side to new businesses that we should think about, is rethinking the corporate tax. Sensible city policies tax the immobile assets of the city, not the mobile assets, not the things that can readily run away, not the wealthy and not small businesses, right? And yet New York has a corporate tax rate that is also one of the wonders of the world, New York City, right? It would surely be more sensible, given every thought of local public finance theory of common economics, to move that towards a tax on real estate, in particular a tax on unimproved land, right? So this is a tax that doesn't scale up with the amount of stuff that you put on top of it, because after all, we want to encourage people to build, but actually is based on the raw value of the land. Secondly, the permitting situation. You know, I'm thrilled that NYC Business Express has created a website where any new entrepreneur can look and figure out the things that they need to do to start a business. This is a great Bloomberg administration initiative. The one weakness of this is it lets you see just how many hoops you have to go through, right? Which are vast, vast, right? So the U.S. as a whole does relatively good in the World Bank's ease of doing business reports in terms of starting a new business. But if you look at where New York would face on its own, right, it's somewhere in the middle of, you know, Kazakhstan versus, you know, sub-Saharan Africa in terms of how difficult it is to start a business. This is not something the mayor can fix on his own. This is legislatively mandated. And it's an absolute necessity. Now, I would do two things in terms of business regulations. One of which is implement cost-benefit analysis for both any new regs and existing regs that are out there. There has been a federal mandate for this for 30 years. And secondly, create one-stop shopping. That doesn't mean that you don't need a fire permit, but it means that one person doles out those permits. So you only have to go to one office that actually then takes care of all of these things. This is something that Devens, Massachusetts has had since the Weld administration. It's a good program. You should also guarantee a time to permit. Last thing, the cost of space is important. I am discouraged by the fact that the mayoral candidates think that affordable housing means more government spending on added affordable housing programs. That is not how affordable space is manufactured. That is not how Houston works. That is not how Atlanta works. That is not how Dallas works. That is not how New York worked in the 1920s when it managed to grow an enormous amount and still remain affordable. Low costs happen by unleashing the cranes through supply, by reducing the regulations that make it incredibly difficult to build in the city. Right. If we want New York to be affordable for both new businesses and people of ordinary means, if we not want it not to be a boutique town, affordable only by billionaires, we need to make it far easier to build than we currently have. We need to rethink the land use regulations, and we need to rethink the policies of putting so much land in historic districts. And I'll end on that.
Thank you, Ed.
I have the task of talking about the budget, which is not directly an economic document, even though, of course, it's heavily influenced by the economy. Now, you know, in the way that the average citizen thinks about the economy as cycles of recession and then expansion, I think that mayors probably get too much credit when things are going well and there's plenty of money in the budget, and they probably get too much blame over the short term when there are larger economic cycles that are driving city economies. However, over the long term, it's very clear, if you look at cities across the country the way I do, that predictable budgets and predictable regulation over the long term influences the economy of a city. Now, I say that with a certain amount of trepidation, because New York has probably one of the most unpredictable municipal budgets in America. First of all, if you look at the tax structure of New York, and Ed has already alluded to this, and E.G., I'm sure, will talk about this to a larger extent, New York draws more of its taxes from more of its tax revenue from volatile taxes than any other municipality I know of in America. Certainly more than other big cities, and much more than other smaller cities and other kinds of municipalities in America. When you layer that on top of the fact that the city's chief industry is in itself a volatile industry, you have an unpredictable budget cycle in the city. And the problem with that right now is that we have entered into a new era, which I don't think the fiscal discussion in this mayor's race is acknowledging, the way it is being acknowledged in other places around the country, maybe in places that are actually in worse shape than New York. Maybe you have to be in even worse shape to understand what's happening. But there are two things to keep in mind. The first thing to keep in mind is that this downturn has been unlike others, because in other budget cycles, certainly going back at least to the 70s, what would happen is you'd see a decline in revenue, or sometimes not even decline in revenue, just a slowing of the pace of revenue growth. And you'd adjust by, let's say, cutting a program, by taking something that had recently been started and paring it back. And soon, within one or two budget cycles, maybe three if you were unlucky, things would come into phase. That has not happened now. The downturn has lasted for so long, and costs have continued increasing for so long. The National Governors Association said in a report that we have essentially experienced a municipal and state reset in America. What they meant by a reset is that all the old formulas, the relationship of compensation to revenues, the relationship of fringe benefits and benefits in general to budgets, has changed across America. Now, it's changed here in New York. I don't think people even understand. Mayor Bloomberg, I think, gave people a hint of this when he said recently that the income tax in New York is now going entirely to fund pension costs annually. I took a look back to 2005. I just picked that number. Let's go back about 8 years. In 2005, the income tax was funding 40% of pension costs. Now, it's taking up, the pension costs are taking up all of it. Now, this is happening, again, around America, and it's been accelerated here. So that, all, as I said, all the formulas are different. Compensation in general, which in municipalities around America averages 70 to 80% of costs. It's a little bit less in New York because New York does other things that other municipalities don't. If you look, for instance, at schools around America, 20 years ago, schools spent 13% of their budgets on benefits. They are now spending 21% of their budgets on benefits. That is an enormous shift, really unprecedented in budget terms. And we don't really know how to stop this, which goes to the second issue that is different about this recession. These costs, as they exist now, are not costs because we started a new program and now we didn't plan for it. These costs are not things that can be grabbed control of simply by saying, let's spend less next year. Many of these costs that are influencing budget deficits around America are costs that have already been incurred in the form of debt and have not been paid for yet. So you simply cannot say, let's spend more next year. This is the problem that cities around America are having and that New York City is having. Now, what makes it worse is that states have different laws, and New York State has among the most constrictive and restrictive laws, which makes grabbing control of these costs, to the extent that it's even possible, harder. In New York State, it's not even a question of not paying for the debt you've already incurred, but in many cases, unless state laws change, employees are allowed to keep incurring that debt once they're on the payroll for the rest of their careers. So it makes grabbing control of this debt extremely difficult. Now, around the country, people are recognizing this, and they're recognizing that this instability is going to become an economic development. It has already become an economic development issue. Rahm Emanuel actually said it best, probably because he's got one of the most difficult situations. He said recently, if we don't grab control of our pension and healthcare costs in this state, he wasn't just talking about Chicago, in this state, you're not going to get people to buy homes in Chicago, and you're not going to get businesses to invest in Chicago. And the Chicago Tribune followed it up by saying, what Emanuel is talking about is businesses don't want to buy into the uncertainty of enormous obligations that they know are going to have to be paid for in taxes. It's a version of what Milton Friedman used to say, which is the government debt is nothing more than taxes that have not been collected yet. We have a lot of government debt in New York that are merely government taxes that have not yet been collected yet. And the reason this is important right now is because there's very little sense, given the volatility of the city's tax structure and given the cycles that the city lives through, there's very little sense that we need to be discussing how to make the city's budget over the long term more predictable for people who are going to invest in the city. And by that, I also mean by the average resident who's going to move into the city and invest either in a home or even in paying rent. Now, in the piece that I wrote in this issue, I go into some detail about how to cut the budget over the short term. We can talk about that. You can read that. One of the things that strikes everybody who looks at the city's budget is just how limited the options are at this particular point, so that everybody is pointing essentially to many of the same budget solutions. But the long-term issue is that what is really rolling out across municipalities in America is a struggle to confront debt that has already been incurred but not paid for in a circumstance in which this debt and the spending on it is crowding out other kinds of services. We see this in New York insofar as we have cut 5,000 cops because in this environment, the brute force option, which is laying people off, is what cities across America, including New York, have essentially been using to solve their budget problems. And because it's really been the only option, the only way, one of the few ways to stop the bleeding. And in an environment like this, where the city's economy stagnated and has only begun to grow, as EJ will tell you, the city's tax structure right now, the city's tax burden right now, it, relative to the size of the economy, is at probably a 20-year high. So the long-term challenge that New York faces in a slow-growth environment where there's very little froth and where businesses are being extremely careful about where they invest is to try to put some predictability back into the city's budget, a very, very difficult task. But without that, all you have to do is read what businesses are saying around the country about how careful they are about where they put their money, and you would understand that the city's biggest threat, the threat that it faces right now, is essentially that we have already taxes that we have not collected money for, the taxes that we have not collected that are already spoken for in the future, and that unless we grab control of that now, it's going to be very difficult to attract investment in the coming years. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. EJ?
Well, stop me if you've heard this one. New York City is the most heavily taxed place in the country. Nobody is falling over in shock, so I assume you've heard that. In fact, that's so familiar to so many people who, those involved in looking at or analyzing government policy and those who don't, that it's taken almost in passing as nothing, not only nothing new, but nothing important. But it is important. And I'd like to get at the issue before getting even into the issue that Steve discussed, which is taxes not collected. If you want to begin to think about how scary the taxes not collected are, I think it'd be a good idea to focus on the taxes the city is collecting. The end of a three-term mayoralty and almost the beginning of a new mayoral term is a good time for a taking stock. And again, while we take for granted the fact that New York City is a highly taxed place, I think it's worth considering just how high New York City's taxes are. And I'm going to go through some of the specifics now, but let me describe it to you this way in general. New York City is unique in many, many ways, as we've heard. Here's one other way in which it's unique. For all intents and purposes, living and doing business in New York City puts you into a position of living and doing business in two states at once. New York City has a tax code that combines all the principal familiar features of a local tax code as seen across the country and a state tax code. It is not only the size of an upper mid-sized state, it taxes like an upper mid-sized state. In fact, the city's taxes alone are higher than some states' taxes. And it imposes local taxes in familiar ways. And you are also taxed, if you live and do business here, by the state of New York sending the money to Albany. That's an extraordinary situation. What are the major revenue sources the city has? Well, the city collects now about $45 billion a year in taxes. $45 billion a year. Now, we're too used to hearing figures from New York City. There are very, very few states that collect $45 billion a year in taxes. The largest tax is the property tax. That's the familiar local-style piece of the tax burden. $18.5 billion on its way to $19 billion in property taxes. But the city's property tax system is almost uniquely Byzantine, complicated, and increasingly unfair. There's four classes of property. One is 1, 2, and 3 family homes, 2 is multifamily residences, 3 is utility, 4 is commercial. And basically, the city's property tax system is designed to heap the bulk of the tax burden to increasing degrees on commercial property and secondarily on multifamily property. And that imbalance has become more pronounced over the last 12 years, a period in which the collections from the personal income tax have more than doubled and have been the leading source of growth on the revenue side of the city's budget. So, for instance, commercial property represents something like 19 or 17% of the total property, and the city pays 41% of the property taxes. The results of this can be seen in comparing to other cities and is one of the main reasons, but only one of them, why New York is the most heavily taxed place in the country. A relatively small apartment building, 20 units, if you look at the biggest cities in every state, New York City's tax on an apartment building is twice as much as the tax on an apartment building in other large cities. If you look at commercial property taxes, again, this is a survey done by a Minnesota group that actually goes into the details of property taxes in order to get it right. New York City's tax on commercial property is 76% higher. Then you look at what the city adds to that, and these are the state-like taxes that the city has. The city has an array of business taxes, a general corporation tax, which functions like a state corporate tax, and which raises $2.5 billion, levied at a rate of almost 8.9%, which in combination with the state corporate tax, which is actually not quite as high, comes up to a total rate of 17.5% on net income allocated to New York City. That's phenomenally high, far higher than any other place in the country. Then we have a tax on unincorporated businesses. There's very few places elsewhere in the country where unincorporated businesses are taxed in this way. That's the tax at the firm level on the partner's share of income in partnerships and in professional partnerships, which are some of the most lucrative and businesses and important businesses in the city. By the way, when politicians in New York complain that the city no longer has a commuter tax, they're wrong. The unincorporated business tax is, in effect, a commuter tax. It's paid at the people who are partners in firms subject to the UBT pay that tax or have that tax paid on their share of the firm's income, whether they live in the city or not. That's another big tax. There's an array of other business taxes, specialized banking tax, utility tax. We have a commercial rent tax. We're unique in putting a commercial rent tax, which is a tax on a tax, on commercial rents below 96th Street. So it's not enough that we levy extraordinarily high property taxes on commercial property. We also tax the rent people pay on that property. Now, Rudy Giuliani eliminated that tax in the outer boroughs, but it remains in effect in much of Manhattan. I could go on and on about the level of these taxes, but let's go last but not least to the city's personal income tax, the resident income tax, to be specific, which is paid on the income earned by people who live in the city. The rate on that tax, the marginal rate, now tops out at 3.9%. In combination with the state income tax, that means the tax rate in New York City on income is the marginal rate is 12.7%. That is by far the highest in the country, the second only to California, which under their recent referendum has increased their tax on million-dollar incomes to over 13%. By the way, I did not mention a tax that kind of falls in between all this, which is the so-called MTA mobility tax, which adds 34 basis points to every employer's payroll. Most economists would suggest that the incidence of a tax like that is on the employee. You can look at that as an added income tax, if you will, or as a some other tax. The sum total of all this is that the marginal combined net of deductibility federal, state, and local tax rate in New York City is now 52%, or over 54% for somebody who is in a partnership subject to the UBT. That's by far the highest it's been since a brief period in the early 90s. And when I mentioned the federal tax, that gets to another subject, which I think policymakers in the city need to be keenly aware of. At the federal level, there is one thing that President Obama and congressional Republicans actually have a good deal of agreement on. And what they're agreement on is that there ought to be a significant curtailment or, if not elimination, of the deduction for state and local taxes, particularly for high-income payers. In his budget, once again, President Obama is proposing a significant reduction in the value of all itemized deductions for, quote-unquote, the wealthy, which is defined as being above $200,000 generally. Republicans in the House in particular, where very, very few members of the majority come from states that are high-tax states, are willing to go along with that. In fact, we're willing to make a deal on those grounds last December. In fact, they'd be happy to get rid of the deductibility of state and local taxes, or to take another approach and cap the value of itemized deductions at a level low enough to essentially eliminate the deduction for high-income payers. Now, the merits of such a policy from a federal tax and federal economic viewpoint are debatable. Reasonable people, I think, can argue both sides of that. A strong case can be made for eliminating a great many deductions. But I'd like to focus on and suggest that people who are going to be running the city in the next 4 years need to think hard about the impact that would have on New York City. It's not only possible, to some extent, it's likely. And let me give you one example. The net tax cost of New York City, net of deductibility, the net tax cost in terms of income tax of living and working in New York City under President Obama's proposal, if it was enacted, would be an added 10%, that is, 10% compared to a no-tax environment, Florida or Texas. So if you want to start at a baseline where there's no income tax, New York's net cost would be 10%. That would be the highest ever, the highest since I've been able to calculate it going back 40 years. Mm-hmm. It's generally been in a neighborhood of 7 to 8%, given the variations in state and local and federal tax policy over the last 30 years. So we'd have a very, very high stake in the outcome of federal tax policy. Federal tax policy is likely to further curtail deductibility, is likely to make this comparatively and even more expensive to live, work, and do business, which is why it's really important for the next mayor to begin to look at tax policy in the way only one other mayor before has looked at it, and that would be Mayor Giuliani. To varying degrees, each and every year of Giuliani's 8 years in office, one of the considerations that was ever present in the formulation of his budget was, and what tax can we cut or continue to cut this year? That was unique. No mayor before or since has gone into his fiscal cycle every year saying, what tax can we cut or continue to cut? Now, a lot of Mayor Giuliani's tax cuts taken individually were not significant on their own. But, for instance, the first of them was a relatively small cut in a hotel tax, but it was symbolically important because it was done despite the fact that the city had a major budget gap. I think that there needs to be a return to the sense that there has to be momentum in reducing this tax burden. It's easy to look back at these taxes, at the massive amount of revenue raised, at the massive holes in the out years of the budget, and say, this cannot be tackled. We cannot do anything about this. But, in fact, the imperative is that something must be done about it, or the city is going to be increasingly uncompetitive in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, EJ. Nicole?
Good morning. Well, speaking of competitiveness, earlier this month, the intelligence unit of The Economist magazine, along with Citigroup, the people that do the bikes, they put out a study ranking the competitiveness of 120 global cities. And New York came out first among all of these cities. The mayor was happy about this. He put out a release saying it was partly a reflection of all of the work he's done over the past 12 years. But this study was very vague about how the analysts came up with these rankings. And so I asked them, where did New York fit in on physical infrastructure? And they said New York was only 25 on the quality of its physical infrastructure. That means out of 120 cities, we didn't even rank in the top 20%. Now, this is worrisome for two reasons. One, although they only gave physical infrastructure 10% of the weightings, everything else in your city depends on physical infrastructure. And the second reason it's worrisome is because we're actually at the pinnacle of 30 years of heavy investment in our physical infrastructure. And if this is all we've come up with, we've got to be nervous about both where we are and where we're going. In fact, if you look over the past three decades, we've had four successive mayors who, although the mayor does not control the biggest portion of our infrastructure that's run by the state through the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which runs subways, commuter rail, and so forth, we've had four mayors going back to Ed Koch who have benefited from steady investment and now expansion of our transit and transportation system. That's good, and the next mayor, if all goes well, will be in the first number 7 train going to the far west side, in the first train of the extension of the 2nd Avenue subway, and so forth. But the problem is we have made all of these investments over the last 30 years by borrowing, and the MTA can no longer do this for the next 30 years and even the next 10 years. So we may see that the next mayor presides over a slide back and a reversal of three decades of progress. And there are some ways that the next mayor can reverse this, but the first way is just to understand the problem. So go back 30 years, early 1980s, Richard Ravitch took over the MTA. Back then, it was in a state of terrible decay. And you can understand this from looking back to 1982 issue of New York Magazine, where the magazine writer said, "It's yet another cold, frigid morning in New York, and we have thousands of commuters standing on subway platforms, waiting for trains that don't come, waiting for decades-old buses that wheeze their way from the depots to the stops, and you know, you don't even know whether the bus or train is going to show up." And they said the transportation system that had once been a symbol of the greatest city on earth was now a symbol of our decline and decay. This was a wake-up call, and indeed, back then when Ravitch took over the MTA, if you had a bus breakdown, you might not get it back out on the streets for a few weeks because the inventory cupboards were bare. And so Ravitch went to the governor and said, "We have to do something about this. The MTA needs a source of revenue." What the governor did back then was say, "Okay, we'll go to the state legislature. Rather than just depend on fares and tolls, the state will now give the MTA a portion of all of these various downstate taxes. So whenever you get a mortgage, the MTA gets a little piece of the mortgage recording tax. Whenever you buy a petroleum product or pay your phone bill and so forth, the MTA gets a little bit of that tax." What the MTA did with those taxes was use them to borrow money. Ravitch did the first dedicated tax-backed municipal borrowing in the country back then, used this money to put $8 billion into the system, into investing in new tracks, new trains, air-conditioned trains and buses and so forth. And over the first decade, what Ravitch said he would do, he did. And people could see a vast improvement in the transit system. That has continued over the past two decades as well. The bad news is that the amount of money that the MTA has borrowed to make these investments has really put it up against the wall. And just over the past 12 years, just over Mayor Bloomberg's three terms, you can see this in the numbers, that the amount of money that the MTA has borrowed has doubled. It was $16 billion back then. Now it is nearly $32 billion. The ratings agencies say the MTA's capacity to borrow has gone from them having borrowed 40% of their capacity to 77% of their capacity. So they cannot repeat this feat. And you may say, well, that's okay because maybe we don't need to expand the system. We don't need to finish the Second Avenue subway, go to phase two. We can just take a break from these new projects. But if you look at what the MTA spends this borrowed capital investment money on, it is not primarily new projects. It is just keeping the system in a state of good repair. And we can see this just from the past few weeks or past few months' worth of news. Just this year, the MTA has had four derailments: Long Island Railroad derailment last week, another LIRR derailment back in March, a subway derailment up in Inwood a couple weeks ago that didn't get a lot of attention, and then the Metro North derailment in early May that sent six people to the hospital in serious condition. Now, the MTA has been very lucky. Derailments, it's like a plane crash. This really shouldn't happen. Derailments cause death, grievous injuries, and so forth. And it's a good thing that no one has been killed on these derailments this year. But it is a wake-up call that to keep the trains just from going off the tracks, you need billions of dollars of investment, about $3 to $4 billion of dollars of investment every year just to keep the system running as it is. You've got to constantly invest in new tracks. You've got to invest in trains that inspect the tracks for broken conditions. And you have to invest in people. Whenever the MTA shuts down the subway system for a weekend, it's often because they've got people out there inspecting the tracks, looking for any defects, deformities, things on the tracks that don't belong there. So this is a huge undertaking. You can't just stop it for a few months or a few years because you've run out of the capacity to borrow. It will slide backwards very, very quickly. Now, what can the next mayor do about this? Well, again, he or she is largely an observer, but certainly does not have to be a passive observer. One thing is to look at what is driving the MTA's operating budget. If the MTA was able to achieve some savings in its day-to-day operating budget, it could spend some of this money on keeping the tracks, the trains, in a state of good repair, wouldn't have to borrow so much. And we see the same thing going on with the MTA's operating budget as we do with the city's operating budget. Pensions, for example, have quadrupled over the past decade or so. They now cost $1.4 billion a year. Healthcare costs have doubled over the past decade. They now cost $2.2 billion a year. In debt costs, also more than $2 billion now. Now nearly 20% of the MTA's budget, almost doubled their share of 10, 11, 12 years ago. So getting these costs down is critical, really, to making sure that we keep our subway and bus system in good condition. Of these three things, pensions are almost impossible, debt is almost impossible. The thing that you can work on is the healthcare costs. How do we keep healthcare costs from rising more than this $2.2 billion and hopefully slow down the growth? Well, the good news is the mayor has the same problem in the city budget. Healthcare costs is part of collective bargaining with the labor unions. All of the city's labor contracts are expired. The mayor can set a good example because we have pattern bargaining. What the city does is often what the MTA goes on to do with its labor unions. The mayor can say, no new contracts with the labor unions until we get city workers to take some responsibility for paying for their own health care, and we get this cost down, perhaps through some way of creative cost sharing, where you look ahead 5 years, you set a target amount for savings in the health care benefit, and you say, we'll share these savings with the workers and with the taxpayers. You do that with the city budget, you set a good example for the MTA to do the same thing with its own budget. If you save, say, $500 million in projected costs over the next decade or so, you're able to alleviate the MTA's borrowing burden, and that can make a tremendous difference. The other thing is you look to what some visionaries in the city are thinking about. Sam Schwartz, who was the city traffic commissioner under Ed Koch, he's been thinking a lot about how do you fund a modern-day transportation system. He's not only worried about the MTA, but also about the city's own bridges. You look at the Brooklyn Bridge, Williamsburg, Manhattan bridges. These bridges do not have their own tolls where they can use the toll money to do maintenance. They depend on just the general city budget. And the part of the budget for maintenance is being cut back. As Steve said, hard to touch pensions, hard to touch other things, so we are touching these things that we can cut. One of those things is maintenance. You cut back maintenance on a bridge too much, and at some point you've got to close down the bridge. And Schwartz knows that. He had to do that in the 1980s with the Williamsburg Bridge. So what Schwartz wants to do is take these free bridges on the East River, put a $5 toll on them, use some of that money to cut back the tolls on the bridges that the MTA controls that are already heavily tolled. So you take the Verrazano Bridge, you take some of the bridges that go from one part of Queens to another, you cut back these tolls that are starting to exceed $10, $12. You use the rest of the money to keep the transportation system in a state of good repair and to make new investments. So make sure you've got Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan Bridge well painted. They're not vulnerable to corrosion. And you start thinking about what else do we need to build? Do we need to build express subway tracks out to the outer boroughs? Do we need to build an elevated busway on some of these highways that go out through Queens, go out to Long Island to give people a better commute? And indeed, as Michael Allegra already said, 62% of New Yorkers agree that these investments are needed, that we need much better transportation to the outer boroughs and beyond from Manhattan. Now, the Schwartz plan is a good plan to consider, but again, as we've seen over and over in the past, we can't get a new source of revenue for transit until we control the cost side. We saw this just 4 years ago, as EJ mentioned. The last new dedicated tax that the MTA got was this payroll mobility tax that the state legislature agreed we're going to levy this 0.33% point tax on everyone's payroll downstate. We'll use this to give the MTA another $1.8 billion a year. And this was supposed to solve the MTA's problems. As the Senate Majority Leader, Malcolm Smith, at the time said, MTA won't be coming to us for a bailout again. Well, if you look at the numbers, that's not true. In just a couple of years, they're going to have nine-figure deficits again and be talking about service cuts, investment cuts. This permanent bailout did not solve the problem because nobody looked at the cost side. So the new mayor can do a great deal of good if he or she says, we want to think about how to rationalize tolls, how to think about getting a good source of revenue for the MTA's capital investments, but not until we've cut back these costs, because otherwise the cost side begins to really suffocate and take away any new source of revenue, and we're right back to where we started. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole. Let me start with a question that relates to some of the things you were just saying, and this is for Steve and Nicole. How much could the city improve its budget situation by going after productivity savings with city unions? We've talked a bit about the healthcare side of this, but could there be significant gains from that side? Steve?
Well, that's, of course, the biggest number out there because right now 95% of city workers don't contribute at all to their health care, and for state workers contribute between 16% and 30% to their health care, and city workers in other cities contribute. Again, it's different at different places, but the Citizens Budget Commission did a study of other cities, including cities like frigid Boston and very warm Phoenix, and the average was 15% to 20%, 25% of premiums that workers were contributing. How much of a difference does that make? Well, you have to also add the fact that the city provides retiree health care, which is something that many municipalities do provide and is becoming one of the biggest issues of contention. And the city provides virtually full premiums, and you know, if you're under 65, if you don't qualify for Medicare, and you're retired, you need full health care, which is very expensive. And I think it's 1/3 of city workers retire before they qualify for Medicare. I think that's the number. But the budget impact is enormous. And again, across America, cities are dealing with this. Chicago, which, for instance, pays only 50% of the premiums for its retirees for health care, recently decided to end the program and to move all of their city workers who are retirees onto the Illinois Affordable Health Care Exchange. So essentially, taxpayers across the country will be subsidizing. Yes, indeed, and so did Detroit, by the way, and it's going to be a very big trend in those places that have started those exchanges, because the cost is enormous. In New York, we pay far more than even Chicago was paying, and Chicago did this because they said flat out it's unaffordable. We pay far more. So depending upon how much you ask workers to contribute, if, for instance, if retirees were paying half of their health care premiums and city workers are paying anywhere from 10 to 20%, you could save more than $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year in the budget just right there. The mayor has suggested other ways of other savings, too, including bidding out the management of the healthcare insurance system, the city's healthcare insurance system, and on their competitive bidding, he thinks the city could save several hundred million dollars. We'll see about that. That has to be negotiated with workers too, just as part of a new contract. But so the numbers are you know, depending on how much you get, are quite large. But it's important to understand that this is something that cities across America are dealing with. And many of them already ask for more, in some cases far more than the New York City asked for, and are still finding that unaffordable. It is a very difficult problem, and if you've seen some of the news stories just in the last week, cities are now discovering the additional burden that they will face under Obamacare. And so we now have cities doing what companies are doing, which is resorting to more and more part-time labor. We haven't seen that impact yet in New York City, in part because New York City already pays such a high burden. But we'll see as the situation evolves. This is part of the problem. When I say there's a new formula out there for budgets in America, for municipal budgets, the costs of employing people are eating at more and more of budgets. And over the last couple of years, cities and states have responded, first of all, by by de-emphasizing other things, which they can no longer de-emphasize because they're simply running out of money to do that, and secondly, by laying people off. And the result is they're doing this even as taxes are rising. 50% of the $7 billion Illinois tax increase went into the pension system. Didn't go to pay down the debt. The other debt didn't go to balance the budget. It went into the tax system. People have estimated that 40% of the California tax increase is going just into the pension system. So we are in an era of municipal government where we are paying more and getting less for it.
What about the productivity savings, though, Nicole? Is that a feasible area to look for some savings?
It's certainly feasible, but one of the challenges for the next mayor is we've got these labor unions in the city who still seem to think, or at least their leaders are saying they think, they're going to get retroactive raises. You saw Teachers Union President Michael Mulgrew in the Daily News yesterday saying, the fiscal people are lying. There's no deficit. The city has been running surplus under the past few years under Mayor Bloomberg. Well, first of all, the city has had an operating deficit for 6 out of the past 7 years. In each particular year, that year's costs were greater than that year's revenues. Why does he say we have a surplus then? Because starting before Lehman Brothers collapsed, the city had built up a surplus of $8 billion. Since then, we have been spending it down every year to plug these operating deficits, and now that money is gone. As for the productivity savings, the problem is with these retroactive raises that you can't be more productive in the past. In other words, the mayor said a few years ago, yeah, the city workers can get raises as long as they pay for it by being more productive. But now these agreements have been expired for 3 and 4 years, and so you can only be more productive in the future. That really means it's yet another reason why the union should not be expecting any retroactive raises. And by the way, there's one place where the city workers have been far too productive, and that's in levying fees and fines on small businesses. That over the Bloomberg term, fee and fine revenue has pretty much doubled. And this goes to the question of what is the purpose of city government? Is it to provide services to the taxpayers, or is it to raise money for the special interests? Because if you are a city resident, you've got idling buses on your block. Your goal is to get rid of the idling buses. The city's goal is to let the buses continue to idle and charge them $1,000 for idling. So they don't want to stop the bad behavior. They want to continue the bad behavior and monetize it. And this is at odds with what the taxpayers want.
Thanks. This is a question for Ed. Is it really such a problem that New York is dominated by large firms? Mayor Bloomberg once referred to New York as a luxury product. So big firms that make a lot of money and can pay a lot of taxes want to be here. That's a great thing. So who really cares if smaller firms spring up? I'm wondering, just from a theoretical standpoint, why that's wrong.
Right. So there are two problems with the view of New York as being uniquely a luxury product. One is about what our vision of the city should be. Cities have shown a remarkable capacity for millennia to be avenues of opportunity for everyone. And a view of New York as being a place that's affordable only to the wealthy is a sad view to me. It's a view that says no to people who can benefit enormously from being in this incredible, vibrant city. But there's a second, more selfish reason why we should care about not being a luxury product, because any great idea that I know of doesn't start as a wealthy, high-tax-paying entity. Right? It starts in a garage. It starts in a small back office. It starts with somebody who actually isn't able to deal with the huge amounts of legal requirements having 15 hoops to jump through to start a business creates. And cities, when you think about sort of the way that cities work, right, they're best seen as nurseries of new ideas. New York once, perhaps 150 years ago, was a place that was, in fact, an incredibly good place to manufacture ordinary products because of those waterways that surround us, because they made us actually a very low-cost place to do business. That has long ceased to be the case. Right, it has been many, many decades since New York was a good producer, a good, sensible place to produce ordinary products cheaply. That originally was true of manufactured goods, right, when globalization hammered that once proud garment sector, and it is also true of business services today. ordinary business services are no longer the province of New York, right? Because in fact, they can be cheaply done somewhere else, someplace that doesn't have an over 8% corporate income tax on businesses to do it. So we need to be smart. We need to constantly come up with high value add products. We need to do those things, right, that come out of this amazing web of genius that is connected by the city. That requires a constant process of new innovation. That requires entrepreneurship. And that's why we have seen in study after study over the past 20 years that places that have lots of small, nimble firms have done much, much better than places dominated by a few large firms. This holds true controlling for anything you can think of controlling at the city level. It holds true within cities. It holds true across industries. No matter what you look at it, small firms are a linchpin of urban regeneration. And I think really it's true that if New York's vision is it's going to be a few wealthy trading firms and investment banks, that's a vision that looks a lot like Detroit in 1952, and that story did not end well.
Thanks. Here's a last question for me, and this is for EJ. A couple of the candidates running for mayor say they want to increase the marginal income tax rate in the city on wealthy voters, wealthy residents. Saying that they should be paying their fair share. How plausible is that as an argument that they're not paying their fair share? And what would be the effects of that increase?
Well, the way most elected officials in New York use the term fair share, this is true in Albany also, fair share is essentially boils down to more. Fair share is an infinitely elastic concept in a place where in both the city and state level, the highest earning 1% of taxpayers generate 43% of the income tax revenue. So in New York City, that's 35,000 households or tax filing units with incomes starting at around around $500,000, generate 43% of the resident income tax. And one can only imagine, by the way, the high proportion of the unincorporated business tax, for instance, and other taxes the city collects that are paid disproportionately by very wealthy people and corporations or high-income households. So, the fair share concept is sort of a joke. It's the kind of thing that's thrown around. I think one thing that polls find, which shows the limits of polls, most of the people, most of the time, have no idea of how much other people pay in taxes. Most of the people, most of the time, thinking Leona Helmsley or anything else that they saw in the paper, that they're all actually paying nothing, whereas me, the working stiff, is paying a lot. If you ask people, there's been a famous experiment, it's been repeated a number of times on the federal level, what do you think people should pay in their income? What's the optimum amount? And they'll say 25%. They don't know that the bulk of high-income households pay even an effective rate of above 25%. So it's the use of that phrase fair share preys on basically the lack of awareness or even ignorance of most voters of where and how the taxes are collected. All proposals to quote unquote increase the fair share or increase the marginal income tax rate are proposals for destabilizing the city's tax base. Plain and simple. There's absolutely no dispute about that. You can look in the report, the annual report of the Ways and Means Committee of the Assembly Democratic Majority about New York State's tax base, which has a similar problem. If you further increase the taxes on high-income households, you further destabilize the tax base. And we've already paid a price for that in terms of this sharp decline, billions of dollars of decline in city tax revenues after the financial crisis. It was only in this past just about to end fiscal year that the city's income taxes recovered to their 2008 level. That kind of volatility will be worse if you increase your dependence on high-income households. So it's a very bad idea. It's destabilizing, and it will create problems for the future.
Thanks. Why don't we start taking questions from the floor? Please wait for the microphone to arrive. And try to keep the questions short and pointed, and please no editorial statements.
Hello, my name is Thomas Lopez-Pierre. I run a small business private equity fund in Harlem, and I'm a real estate broker. My question is on tax and budget policy. About 45% of the population in New York City is black and Latino and very poor. I myself was a heroin baby, born addicted and a warded estate for many years. How are we, in terms of the budget and taxes, going to lower taxes if the Black and Latino community is very poor and dependent on government? Oh, yes, and if you cut programs, then you have to increase prison expansion. If you ignore the community, the Black and Latino community, you're basically going to have to build more prisons, and you're basically going to spend more tax dollars.
Well, is that a question that I should?
I can take it.
Well, I'll start. Yeah. I think there were two answers to that question. The first part is that the most important thing for the population you're talking about, for all poor people in New York City, is to have a tax policy and a fiscal structure that encourages economic growth, that doesn't hinder it. And unfortunately, what we have now is a tax structure that does hinder economic growth and hinders entrepreneurialism, number one. Number two, you're getting at something that I tried to allude to earlier on, which is, okay, you've got a structural budget gap on the one hand in a budget, despite strip mining, the biggest concentration of wealth perhaps in the world, which is Manhattan south of 96th Street, the biggest concentration of personal and corporate wealth in the world, which you strip mine with your revenue structure, you still have structural budget imbalances that you have to address. So, yes, that's a challenge. I think you have to go at it in a concerted way, and it has to be one of the things you're doing every year. You have to establish priorities. Some programs are more important than others, and some taxes should be targeted before others. And I think that what you need to do is to set about making progress every year on a gradual basis, and also adopt one approach over another approach. The approach of current city politicians, and this is again true in Albany, is to favor targeted tax breaks. You've created this enormous uncompetitive tax structure, and then the way you deal with its consequences is that you target breaks to favored industries. What we need to do is to take an approach that is categorical and broad-based, target entire categories of tax and reduce them on a broad base, with a broad-based approach. You can't overnight do all of this, but I would point out taxes as a share of the city's GDP during the Giuliani era, 8 years, went down a full percentage point of GDP. That's like $6 billion. They're now back up to where they were in the early 90s. In other words, we had an economic boom, okay, a bubblicious one, but we had a surge in revenue, and during that period, we did not use the opportunity that created to begin to make some further progress in realigning our tax structure, and at the very least, not allowing it to surge back to previous levels. So I think that those are some ways that need to be pursued to address this.
I think you're making the assumption that our budget problems right now are being caused by programs that are essential, when our budget problems are being caused by are now being focused here in New York and virtually in every municipality in America on, in fact, employee costs. Nicole can give you some of the numbers, but I believe the average cost of employing a sanitation worker in New York City is now $150,000 per worker. What's happening, and it's interesting, if you look at the municipal level in America, not the state level and certainly not the federal level, and you look at the mayors who are grappling with budget problems across America, they are almost all Democrats. Look at what Cory Booker is facing in Newark. Look at what Rahm Emanuel is facing in Chicago. Look at what Dave Bing faced. And they are saying essentially the same thing, that we are not going to provide good schools. We are not going to be able to provide safe neighborhoods. We've cut 5,000 cops in New York in order to balance the budget, precisely because what we are now spending money on is not, in fact, programs for people, is not better services. We're paying money. We are spending money now on costs that we have incurred, even though we never set the money aside for that. And so that is, when I talked about the giant reset in government, that is the giant reset in government, that we are spending more, and whoever you are, whether you're a middle-class person who sends your kids to the schools or you're someone who relies on programs, you're getting less for it because of that. And the numbers are quite extraordinary here, as they are in New York City. Only in Nassau County, where the average The cost of employing a police officer is $203,000 a year. Are they greater than just about any place I can think of in America? So that is the fundamental tension, if you will, and it's occurring everywhere in America. I think it's exacerbated here. But we did have, as Nicole said, we did have that $8 billion cushion, I believe it was, that has, to a certain extent, cushioned New York in ways that it didn't other places. But we're seeing that now disappearing. So that is the problem, that everybody who relies on any level of municipal service faces in the coming years.
Yeah, I just want to say something briefly to connect this with Brian's question earlier. Social service provision is one of the areas which I think it is most possible to imagine dramatic improvements in productivity, in part because often the productivity of these social services are extremely low. And I would roll schools into this as well, which is why it's so important to be thinking about things like social impact bonds, which are just really a way to get incentives into the system and to get more experimentation into the system. Because I think certainly there's a model that says we can contain these costs, perhaps even shut them to a far better job of caring for our less advantaged members of the city. The second point, which I think I want to make, and I don't want to at all suggest that the second point is means that we can walk away from this at all, because I agree completely with the sentiment of your question. But the second point, which is central, is that fundamentally, in a federalist structure, caring for the poor, caring for the least advantaged, has to be a federal, not a local responsibility. If you try to run a local safety net, the rich and businesses just leave, right, as we saw happening in the 1970s. Now, given that that's not where we are in New York, I understand that, but just conceptually, I think that point should always be on the table, that we should not, you know, we're in a very second-best environment, and fundamentally, the poor are everyone's responsibility, not just their near neighbors. Cities attract poor and rich people because they are good places to be rich, and they are good places to be poor, but that should not mean that the rich living in the cities bear an untoward and extreme responsibility for caring for the poor that are next to them.
Okay. Herb London, right here in the middle.
Thank you. EJ, I'm very impressed by the concern that you've expressed for economic growth in the city. Obviously, it's necessary, and all of the panelists have made reference to it. I want to engage you in a thought experiment. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that we eliminated the UBT, the unincorporated business tax, and the commercial rent tax. What would that do for economic growth in New York City?
Well, okay.
Yeah, sure.
It would do a lot for economic growth in New York City. I would hesitate to be specific without working with one of my friends in the economics profession to kind of come up with a way to try to model it. But I think it would do a lot to both retain firms that are here and sole proprietors who are here, and to encourage others to remain here and others to come here and to start businesses here. So, I mean, it would obviously have an enormous impact. Was the for instance, just to eliminate the UBT is an exceptionally high tax compared to other places, and it would really do a lot. You could almost take your pick of different taxes. You're going at a whole category of tax. I think that's one way to think about it. I think that one way, by the way, to quote-unquote afford to do that would be to eliminate breaks that are given to entire industries for activities, in some cases, ironically, for activities that are more likely to be done here despite our high tax burden. I have in mind the motion picture and TV production credit, for instance, which we cite at the end of my article in the City Journal. If we think about it, there are some businesses that are more prone to coming to New York and engaging in economic activity in New York than others because of New York's uniqueness. They're attracted to New York, including but not limited to the fact that it's a great backdrop. And yet we actually go out of our way to actually subsidize that activity while maintaining high rates on people who engage in more humdrum activities that are far more important to the future of the city. So I think that that's the right way to go, I think. And I think the way to begin paying for it is to re-examine the credits and the targeted subsidies we give through the tax code to other businesses, including, again, businesses that engage in activities here that it might be doing it anyway. Let me give one example. I'll give one quick example. We use the example at the end of this article of Jimmy Fallon and the NBC The Tonight Show studio, which is a state tax credit heartily applauded by Mayor Bloomberg when it was worked into as a special deal into the latest state budget. So the state of New York and its taxpayers are going to subsidize the construction of Jimmy Fallon's new studio for The Tonight Show. Okay? Jimmy Fallon, born in the Hudson Valley, attending college in Albany, has worked all of his life in New York and no doubt wants to stay in New York himself, okay? 20 years ago, CBS renovated an entire theater for David Letterman for the same amount of money that NBC, adjusted for the economy, is going to spend on The Tonight Show with no subsidy. Why? Because he wanted to be in New York. That industry, that business, entertainment, wants to be here. In fact, is less susceptible. That's not an argument for high taxes in general, but if any industry is less susceptible to being deterred by our high taxes, it's that industry. And yet we're subsidizing that industry more than any other industry, almost bar none. So that's the kind of, I think we have to rethink what we do along those lines. Thanks.
You know, having won the Manhattan Institute Lifetime Achievement Award for Social Entrepreneurship, I know something about creating jobs for people at the bottom of our society. And I think that one of the things that we're not talking about is this endless right to shelter that we have in New York City, where 20% of the people who come into our shelter system, last known address is someplace else. So, for example, a person in Jersey City who wants an opportunity just gets on the path, comes over here, goes to Bellevue, checks in, and we don't have a right to ask them whether or not there's some other opportunity like family in Jersey City that we can call up and send you back to. We can do that with homeless families, but we don't have the right to do that with homeless single adults. The social cost of homelessness in New York City is $1 billion a year now. When I started, it wasn't a line item in the budget. There are tremendous things that we can do in putting people to work. So I'm not going to make that a speech. I do have a question for Ed. I was walking in Central Park many years ago, and I came upon a statue of a man by the name of Henry George. And it said, progress and poverty. And I said, gee, that's interesting, because that's what I'm interested in. I went and I got the book. It was written in 1879. And Mr. George advocates the taxation of vacant land, of land, not what you build on it, but unimproved land. So what do you think of that as a big idea?
You know, Henry George said a lot of crazy things, but he was actually right on this one. Absolutely. I mean, the key point here, and this is so, you know, it illustrates how completely backwards the actual city property tax system is, right? I mean, the key point is you want to tax the immobile asset because it distorts things least, right? So the things that are mobile, firms, wealthy people, even the amount of structure you put on land is deterred, right, by having high real estate taxes that go up with that, right? So the idea is we tax a lot based on the intrinsic value of that lot rather than actually taxing the structure that you put on it. So if you're taking a downtown lot empty and keeping it as a parking lot, you don't get minimal taxes on it. You actually have to pay the taxes that the lot is worth. And I think one of the advantages of that, and notice it goes directly against giving tax breaks to people who have low-rise houses on their area relative to putting apartment buildings. And one of the advantages of that is you actually want more supply of space. The last thing you want to be doing in New York is deterring the providing of space that actually is the only solution for making the city more affordable for both businesses and people. And I think, you know, rather than, although, you know, if you want to launch a Georgist crusade on this issue, I'm with you. But just if you wanted to sort of be more reasonable, just something that moved towards a simpler, more sensible property tax regime, perhaps with a mild density reduction in some sense. You charge more for lower density areas and less for higher density things on the same space would be a way of moving towards a full Georgist move.
I want to chime in favor of that also. I think the land value tax is an idea that's long since come that deserving of experimentation in New York. New York is big enough and diverse enough so that you could, although this would require state legislation, pronounced eye roll, you could target a few areas, perhaps all of the Bronx or entire sections of different outer boroughs, with a land value tax approach. I think that's you're definitely onto something. And I think, by the way, that's an idea that unites right and left. I think there's a lot of analysts across the ideological spectrum in New York who would be enthusiastic about participating in developing a reform of the tax system that at least allowed that.
Interesting. Thank you for that question. We'll move back to the middle right here.
Ed Cox, anyone who's negotiated a labor contract with the city and I want to get back to your productivity point. There's just a myriad of small items that limit management's ability to really manage the labor force. And yet no one really focuses on that in the negotiations. There's an artificial trade-off between increases in salaries and eliminating some of these. Are those small, like the regulatory things that Professor Glaser pointed out, if a lot of those were eliminated, are they really a limitation on management? Could we have a much more productive labor force in the city if the next mayor really negotiated a lot of those, just saying, let's get rid of those, we get more productive labor force as a result of that?
Let me start. First of all, I may disagree with you that we don't have mayors who have been doing that. We have a mayor who at least asks for that and then is told no, and that's it. The answer to the question is pretty easy. When you look at any place that essentially contracts out its municipal services and you see what the savings are in a competitive environment, you immediately see some of the costs that you're talking about. I remember when I was in the early 90s at Cranes, and this was when David Dinkins was the mayor. David Osborne, who wrote Reinventing Government, which was a bestseller at that time, came to New York. David Osborne, who every time I talk to him, reminds me he's a liberal Democrat. every time I talk to him, a book essentially about a managed competition for cities. He came here, and one seat in the front row was Rudy Giuliani writing everything he said, and the other seat was Mark Green writing everything he said. Everybody across the political spectrum was reinventing government. That movement died almost as quickly as it rose, and it died in part because the big public sector unions said, this is a direct threat to us. Giuliani, to a certain extent, in his first term, did use privatization and managed competition as a wedge in contract negotiations. I do not believe the word privatize has ever left Mayor Bloomberg's lips that I can recall in his... But the answer to your question is actually easy to figure out. Simply take a look at what bidding out a particular service... Chicago is another good example. They have not only one of the few cities in America like New York that still has their own sanitation force, but they have something like 140 different sanitation districts. Every alderman has his own sanitation district, gets to contract out but just look at what privatizing a service does in terms of the actual costs, and you can quickly figure out what the savings are. But 12 years, I don't think I've heard the word managed. All right. Steve Goldsmith, the former mayor of Indianapolis, said privatize is a dirty word. Competition, managed competition, competitive bidding of services. Don't think I've heard those phrases from this administration in 12 years.
Charter schools, right? Charter schools are the great example of the productivity advantages that can occur. You got to fire bad teachers, hire good teachers, lengthen the school days, and ideally front load more compensation in terms of wages up front and get rid of the very high cost benefits ex post.
Okay, we have time for a few more questions.
My name's Harry Lewis. I'm an attorney here in Manhattan. I heard two basic themes from the panel today, one being barriers to entry to doing business, to starting new businesses in New York is a problem. And the second, and it sounds like the more significant and substantial current issue, is the concept that labor union contracts, particularly pensions and other benefits, are starting to crowd out municipal services and, according to Nicole, municipal infrastructure. I've heard this theme before, that we had the treasurer of Rhode Island come in to talk about how she had sat down with the unions up in Rhode Island. Rhode Island probably has a smaller budget than the city of New York, but what she did generically was to, of course, put together a series of numbers, sit down with the unions, present them to them, and show them how this crowding out phenomena would eventually, and in Rhode Island, I think pretty quickly, start to cause the elimination of union jobs, municipal jobs, because that money instead would have to be paid for the pensions of past employees. So it just seems to me that you know, that notion could be presented to the unions effectively in New York, except apparently that New York has been relatively successful as cities go and is perceived probably by union employees as being extremely wealthy and able to pay the freight, if you like, well beyond that of other municipalities. So I guess my question to the panel is this. Is that perception that New York is a very wealthy city more successful, say, than Detroit or other failing urban areas, an impediment to getting this problem solved?
Let me be more extreme.
Short answer.
Let me be more extreme. You actually only get these major changes if you're facing disaster,
yes,
which is the Rhode Island point. You actually need to be facing a crisis. And I think it's important to remember, you know, John Lindsay was elected on a promise of getting tough with the unions, and Mike Quill took him out to the woodshed, right? I mean, you know, it's very, very hard to face the unions. So I would say if you took away from this that actually the cost of government is the big thing for us to focus on, I actually don't think that's true because it's just much harder to fight that one, whereas the regulations, I think actually we can do something about it, which is not to say that we shouldn't be paying attention to it, but it's the harder one to tackle.
There's no question that that's a problem, and because the tax base, this is the problem, all right? Whenever I talk about the city's taxes, or when you get into a mixed audience, especially a more mixed politically audience, and you say this, the question is asked with something between an edge in the voice and a snarl. Oh, yeah? Well, how have we done so well economically the last few years if our taxes are such a problem? The answer is, of course, first of all, the basic answer is what I think it was Bastiat called what is not seen, okay? What are we not getting in the way of economic growth now and the future because of this tax burden? How is it already distorting incentives and distorting the outlines of our economy? The problem is that when you say, you know, taxes are a problem for competitiveness, they have a pervasive impact on the cost of the city and filter through to the cost of everything. The answer will be, well, we gained 2% unemployment last year. What's the problem? And the problem is you could have done much better, and you could have a city that's much better and offers much better opportunity on a much more affordable basis for hundreds of thousands, indeed millions more people, if you weren't doing this. And that is the problem, but that is absolutely the problem. The key question in the tax area is, and really this is where you separate two different mindsets in people running for mayoralty, is can New York City continue to pretend or behave as if it can tax with impunity? Can you tax with impunity? There are more than a few politicians out there who believe the answer is yes. And they will not believe the answer is no until everything's falling down around their ears. That's because that is a key question. Obviously, if taxes were the only thing that mattered, this would have been a ghost town by 1978. Because everything else was terrible and the taxes were terrible. So there is something unique and you know wonderful about New York, despite all this, manages to be what it is. But what people don't see and refuse to contemplate is what it could be if this tax burden and tax structure was not what it is.
Also, when I hear, well, why did we continue to do at least reasonably well in the last couple of years, I think of the response that I heard around the country when Mayor Bloomberg suggested that, and that was that you were the only city that got $800 billion in TARP money that basically kept your essential institutions alive to the extent that no other industry in America received that money. And what we don't understand is the extent to which the opportunity jobs have continued to leave anyway. Right now, if you go to the website newgeography.com, run by Joel Kotkin, another one of our contributing editors at City Journal, there is a study which is titled provocatively, "The Cities in America That Are Stealing Financial Wall Street Jobs from New York." And it is all about the growth of financial services everywhere else in America. Those jobs are not the jobs, the investment banking jobs that average $350,000 a year. That's the average salary of securities. But they are jobs like in Richmond, Virginia, 15,000 commercial banking jobs, paying 60 to 70 to 80,000 jobs. Jobs that used to be in New York City. Commercial banking topped out in New York City in the mid-'80s with 130,000 employees. There are now 40,000 commercial banking jobs in New York City. That's how many they are everywhere else in the country. So that is part of the issue right now, that what we are seeing essentially is a growth of high-level and low-level jobs, but I would urge you to go look at this study of what kinds of financial services jobs are being created around the rest of America.
Yeah, I mean, the economy suffered a horrendous meltdown that ravaged the entire economies of entire states in some places. The federal response to this was consisted almost entirely of a desperate effort to prop up our main industry. So, I mean, that also had something to do with how we did during the recession.
And one thing is reversing itself right now is rock-bottom municipal bond rates. Sunday night, the mayor said, we closed our deficit this year partly with $200 million in savings because interest rates were lower than we thought they would be, and we were able to refinance our municipal debt. Now, we've been doing this every year since 2008. The next mayor may face the opposite, that borrowing rates are higher than he or she expected, and that means you've got an extra nine-figure deficit that you've got to fill.
Well, on that somewhat gloomy note, let me conclude, and I want to thank all of you for coming today. Thank our panelists for a very stimulating presentation. Each of the panelists has a wonderful essay in this special issue of City Journal, and we're going to do one more of these briefings on education. It will be July 9th, I believe, is the date, 8 a.m. again for registration there. So thank you all again for coming very much.
Thank you,
Nicole.